Welcome to Business News and Other Shit. I'm your host, Amr. Thank you so much for tuning into a show that's been called the perfect listen for busy fifth graders with ADD. I'm an entrepreneur and an aspiring stand-up comedian, improviser, and my favorite job, stay-at-home dad. In a previous life, I graduated from the University of Chicago, the Harvard of the Midwest, with an AB in economics. And after that, for 10 long years, I worked as an executive director for JP Morgan. Sold my soul. You may be asking why someone in their right mind with a wife and two kids would give up such a prestigious and profitable position to become a lowly comedian. And to that, I would say, it's way more fun and maybe don't be such a jerk about it. Our goal with the show is to entertain you with funny stories, jokes, and one-liners about investing and business and money, and hopefully make you a stronger and more financially secure person. Basically, we want to help you increase the size of your backup stash. Backup stash being that secret stash of money that keeps you afloat after you tell that horrible boss to get the hell out of here, or you want to travel around Southeast Asia for the next 6 months. Join us every Thursday. We tell some funny stories, jokes, have a good old time. And you know what? Maybe learn a few important things.
Have you read the book Deep Work by Cal Newport?
Yes, I haven't read the whole book. I've read big chunks of it, so I know deep. I know very well. I try and practice it as much as I can, and all his principles.
Yeah. So thinking it through, I think a lot more of us these days are plugged into the matrix pretty much most of the day. I mean, with knowledge work, it's not really possible to unplug. There aren't it's not like in a factory where you take a break, a union break, and then you go sit and have coffee or you sit and have lunch. I don't know. That was never my world. And my wife's an ICU doctor. I know for her, she definitely is not taking breaks like we are. And then with all the companies that I work with doing consulting stuff, I hear of very few that get breaks. But the point with the Deep Work book, which hopefully the audience can check out because I think it's a badass book.
Awesome book.
It's just that we, anymore, what's really valuable in the knowledge economy is intellectual property and thinking through stuff. And we're also busy doing stuff that we never have the time to actually slow down and think and do that deep work. And so many of us don't want to, because it's a lot easier to just process things all day, to quickly answer emails, to take phone calls, and to do all that shallow work. So again, I know I digress, but I just
No. So, okay, brother. So this is so powerful, man, because about a year ago, maybe 9 months ago, I took over my late father's restaurant. He had a restaurant business for so many decades, and I've not taken it over as part of other things that I'm doing. But it's really sucked me in. And I find that it's way easier to just do shit that is shallow, like the email, like dealing with these employees, like dealing with this chef problem, like dealing with this customer problem, than to actually stop and reflect on what's happening about me, you know? And it's almost like it allows me to kind of go numb, you know, and not feel and not think and not do the harder, deeper stuff. Because the truth is, I think some of the deep work is harder work. You know, you kind of got to exert and squeeze more of your mind and squeeze more out of yourself. And so, but I feel like without doing that work, and this is what Cal obviously says, you don't have any competitive advantage. You're just like everyone else, a servant or a slave to the ding on your computer, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's... look, I don't think I'm not recommending or trying to say that I just spend all day in a state of deep work zen. I mean, I think there are probably a few artists who accomplish that or who we think do that. But I think for me, it's really trying in the mornings to spend the first hour or two of my day really doing some deep work stuff so that when the whirlwind starts to get me, like right around 9 or 10, when everybody starts emailing and calling me, and then I don't know where the day is going to go. And then right. I'm just really responding to other people's agendas, which is really what an email is. If somebody emails me and I respond, they're really controlling my agenda. But for me, it's the first couple hours when I'm freshest in the morning is when I try to do my writing or thinking work or heavy processing.
So wait, let's just go back to that email point. You're saying in some sense, email, truth be told, is someone making an attempt to control your agenda?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Like when you sent me a note and you're like, will you come be on the show? The time I spend responding to that isn't me doing deep work. It's just me processing logistics for something that you wanted to get done. So now I'm reacting. It's not proactive at all. So in the mornings though, from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., that's when I'm on my agenda. You know, if I'm working on a white paper because I'm trying to think through what's the world going to look like in 5 years post-corona? Right. Because I think that's the real stuff. Like for me, it's figuring out how can I consult with companies and help them figure out what the world will look like in 5 years and figure out how to rock the recession. That was the whole point of the book, because that's how I really add value for all my clients. It's not just responding to emails or phone calls. Yeah. But I totally get it. It is, I mean, I do a lot of that too, because you can't, I don't think anybody can really go 12 hours just doing deep work stuff. That'd be, right.
No,
that's not me.
Yeah, that would also, I'd be off balance for sure. Wow, man. Just to go back also a step too, I can't ignore this, man. Your wife is an ICU doctor?
Yeah, she's a pediatric ICU doctor at Rainbow Babies in Cleveland.
Okay.
And she's actually in the middle of a 100-hour work week right now. But fortunately, in Ohio, I think since our state was shut down very early,
you guys were right on top of that.
Our curve is pretty flat, and so I'm hopeful that you know, we all get through it safely. But that's really my biggest concern right now, in all candor, with the whole corona thing, is just the personal health and safety of my wife and my family, since she's going into a hot spot every day.
Right.
And I'm concerned too, because the hospital has asked her to reuse her mask, so it's not just stuff that we're seeing on CNN or Fox or wherever you get your news, but stuff that we're living too.
I don't know what you mean by that. They've asked her to reuse her mask, meaning she won't dispose of her mask. She has to reuse it, which obviously is
correct. Not sanitary. Yeah, so generally in between every patient, you would be throwing away your mask and putting on a fresh one. But right now, because of all the shortage of personal protective equipment in our country and all over the world, they're like, you need to reuse this mask in between patients until it becomes so soiled that it's just unusable.
Wow. And then you connected that to something about what we're seeing on CNN and TV. Are they saying something different on TV?
No, I mean, they're talking about how there's a shortage of masks and personal equipment all over the place. And so I was just thinking through, for me, that's it's real.
You're living. Right. Yeah. I'm in the restaurant I own is in Hyde Park in Chicago, which is the same area where University of Chicago is. And I went to school there. And I got to tell you, man, I visited those doctors and that hospital more than once when I was in college. They took good care of me, you know? And so I saw an idea on Instagram that I stole, and it was a great idea, which was another restaurant in San Francisco out there promoting people, regular lay people, to donate money to the restaurant so that they can provide meals for healthcare workers. And so I'm like, this is an awesome idea. I love these doctors and these hospitals. They took such good care of me. Here's a way to give back. And so I started promoting it on social media, and it's kind of blown up a little bit. I mean, it's not millions or thousands, but we're definitely well into the hundreds, close to 1,000 of people just like supporting, sharing, giving. And so we're just bringing in money and sending out hot meals to all these doctors and nurses in the ICUs and in the other kind of COVID units. And that has like been, for me, what's kind of given me sanity in all of this chaos is just doing a little bit. It's not like a big deal. I'm not saving anyone's life, but it's just like, yo, doctors, nurses, we on the outside got your back. Here's some free food and you weren't expecting it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally get it. And I saw my friends at Cuthbert Greenhouse in Columbus, Ohio, are doing the same thing where they're having people donate to them, and then they're in turn donating flowers for funerals, for retirement homes, for hospitals, because also for them, they produce a lot of Easter lilies, and they're getting hammered right now. Wow. I mean, just think through, like, you know, people, obviously a lot of their clients can't use them right now. They sell through a lot of grocery stores, and obviously that's challenging right now. So I think that's great. But it's a small world, dude. My wife went to medical school at Midwestern University in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And so when I was doing banking, I was commuting back and forth to Chicago every weekend I could. And so as I think through it, it's a tough time to be a restaurateur. I mean, I was 2 days ago listening to Dr. Fauci was on a podcast, and they were asking him, so what's it like when we reopen the world? What does that look like? And he used the example, I don't know how many seats your restaurant has.
About 75 to 80.
Okay, so perfect. So Dr. Fauci said, imagine that you have a 50-seat restaurant. You'll reopen, but you'll reopen with 25 seats so that you can just have twice as much space in between all the patrons.
Wow.
Now, I think he's a brilliant doctor, but I don't think he understands business.
No.
For restaurants, you know, during the week, you hopefully cover your overhead. Then on the weekend, you hope to have at least two turns.
You got it.
That way you can make money because it's a very thin margin business. It's very competitive, very tough. So you tell me when you go to reopen, can you do it with 35 or 40 covers? I mean, how does that work? It just doesn't, I don't understand. I don't have a good answer, but I don't know how we're going to do this.
I've been in communications with like my right-hand guy and my chef and, yeah, we've actually talked about that. And the reality is no way. Having half the seats in the restaurant. I mean, here, you want to know how it could work, Jonathan? If my landlord agreed, because I'm going to have half the seats, to cut my rent in half, or actually probably a little more, to be honest with you, then I can sneak away with half the seats. Maybe. Or better yet, here's the other thing. I still got to heat the whole restaurant. I got to heat all 80 seats. I got to put the AC on for all 80 seats. I got to light up all 80 seats. It's not like I can light up every other, you know what I'm saying? What the fuck is that?
I don't know. But there's a great, the other thing that concerns me is if you look at Nanjing, China, they put out a video and it shows how they reacted to the coronavirus, what they had to do to cut the incidents. Mm-hmm. And so they show McDonald's. And at McDonald's, they are able to cut down to obviously half the tables. And so they put a placard on every other table to block it. Mm-hmm. And then you're not even allowed to sit across from the other patrons. So if you and John, who I know is patiently sitting on the podcast with us, if you guys went to lunch at McDonald's in Nanjing, you would sit next to each other, one table apart. You're not even allowed to sit across from each other. And that's how they flatten their curve. I don't think this country is ready for that.
No.
I'm really worried that we're not only gonna have a single dip, but that this will be one of those where we're probably going to reopen the country. That's my prediction at the end of this month. And then probably face at least a second wave of this. So I'm pretty worried about that.
Right. Wow. John, do you want to sit two seats down from me at McDonald's in China?
I would not even talk to you, or I just pretend you're someone else.
Jonathan, that's how me and John Dolan go to McDonald's right now. We just sit like three seats apart.
Yeah, even if we're the two non-Chinese people in China, I'd still pretend not to know you.
Totally understood.
So yes.
Have you guys seen the new McDonald's logo?
What? No.
So you're not supposed to mess with your logo ever. That's like one rule in marketing and business. But just to have some fun with it, Audi did the same thing and separated the rings.
Wow.
And so I think as we think through it, there's we can have some fun with how brands approach this. But
I love that.
Yeah.
Social distance the logo.
Exactly.
There's no way. So we've already moved into, like, literally on day one or day two, we moved into like, okay, this is a game changer. This is going to accelerate everything. We're in the University of Chicago area, so a lot of our business is based on the university. They're fucking closed. Like, they're gone. So we already got on top of it, step ahead of it, just so we wouldn't have to go bankrupt. Talk to my landlord right away. We just went to like skeleton staff. We started promoting the healthcare, meals for healthcare, that started to work a little bit. We got really good at doing individually packaged meals.
Yep.
We ran a video showing how we double wrap all the food. We wear masks, gloves in the kitchen, of course. Double bag everything so that the outside bag, which is full of germs, gets just tossed right away and you just use the clean inside bag. You know, no napkins, no plasticware. You got to do that on your own because, you know. So that all worked. We did a lot of that marketing that helped. And so we're still down 75-80%, but it's keeping the lights on. But then we're like, all right, everyone is at grocery stores right now. That's where the game is at. So we quickly also moved into prepackaged meals. Mm-hmm. And so we are doing a lot of that too, and that helps too, where you put it on grocery shelves and people will grab it and buy it, and that's been good for us too. And so I think, you know, coming out of this, that's not going to change. Like you said, people are going to be slow to come back, and that's assuming we have permission from the state of Illinois or the government, the federal government, to actually reopen at full capacity, which we're not gonna. So we got to do something to keep the lights on if we want to stay alive through this, and go another 28 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of the content of the book is really I didn't want to write regurgitate the same thing everybody always says about recessions, which is you just cut overhead, you fire people, and you try to survive. Like, that book's already been written. This one is more like we talk to people that made a lot of money in the Great Recession, that were successful at growing their businesses and thriving as a result, and use the recession as an opportunity, because a lot of entrepreneurial things happen in recessions. Like, when we look back at the Great Recession, that's where the gig economy came from.
Right.
And so trying to think through with the corona crisis, you know, and this thing, I probably screwed up, Amr, and I don't know if I've said this on any other shows yet, but I was thinking about this during my deep work. I shouldn't have called it Rock the Recession. I really should have called the damn book Dodge the Depression, because really the numbers that we're seeing already really mean that this, what's coming for the U.S. will be a lot closer to the Great Depression,
yes,
than the Great Recession experience. Yeah. And what I'm worried about is really that I don't think a lot of people are there yet psychologically. I think it's like the phases of grief, like how you first go through like shock,
yep,
and then you go through anger and, yep, denial, and ultimately you get to acceptance. There's bargaining and testing and.
By the way, John never makes it to acceptance, just so you know.
I stay at number four. I skip the first three and just go to number four.
Yeah, he's stuck at denial.
Yeah.
John still how doesn't those, believe how those, how John those, thinks this is a Republican conspiracy.
What's that?
John thinks that coronavirus is just a conspiracy.
You mean
Alex Jones made this whole thing up. I'm telling you.
So wait, how are the five phases related to Dodge the Depression?
Well, just that for entrepreneurs, I mean, for the audience listening in, and you're thinking about, like, I'm a financial advisor. And, you know, once we get over this, the world's just going to go back to normal.
Yeah, bullshit.
This will be a V-shaped recovery, or at worst, maybe a U-shaped recovery, and we come back out of it. I really think that's denial. Like, people are just not thinking through that when 17 million people are unemployed in less than a month, and that's probably underreported because, yes, so many people can't even apply that want to apply yet.
Dude, keep your line of thinking. I got to interrupt you. I've got staff. Multiple staff have come up to me, and they're like, hey, can you help me? I'm like, what? They're like, I've applied multiple times. The system either goes down or they won't take an appointment for me, or this or that. They're trying to get unemployment. And I'm like, I don't know. And so they send me screenshots. I'm trying to figure it out with them, but we haven't figured it out. There's multiple people on my own staff that have not successfully applied for, or they'll get rejected for some reason. Like, they're saying, oh, you didn't fill this out perfectly. So it's like, holy shit. So, like, yeah. I mean, what's the number up to? 17 million? That is just bonkers to me. Bonkers. Yeah, we're once you hit 20% unemployment, right? You're in the world of depression, obviously.
Yeah, well, I mean, for the Great Depression, if we go back to 1933, at its height, we hit 25% unemployment, and GDP fell by 27%. If you think about the Great Recession, which they called the Great Recession because it was greater than the prior recessions, the big one. The interesting thing to me has always been that GDP only fell by 5%.
Yeah, it was
a recession. And at its height, unemployment was at about 10%.
Yeah, which is with like, I think 10 million total losing their jobs is my guess.
Yeah, I don't know that exact number, but I am confident 10% at its height. But so I think the numbers we're seeing right now, the whole point, Amr, is just the numbers we're seeing right now are a lot closer to depressionary numbers than they are to recessionary numbers.
Yeah.
And so it's if you're a business owner or even if you're, you know, a financial planner and you're going back to work, the whole world is going to be very different. So I think you're on it when it comes to how do you pivot owning a restaurant? What does that look like?
Yeah.
But it's not going to just bounce back. And then I also think that this trend towards people shopping in grocery stores, I think that's going to accelerate. And then I really think grocery stores are in for trouble because I think that grocery stores are going to be going away following all of this too.
Why?
I think people are going to want to order and have things delivered. They're, you know, what we're seeing from, like I was looking at research coming out of Australia, they have 1 or 2% more people are ordering groceries online now than a month ago. So, I mean, just think about how as people do that and they realize the convenience of online grocery shopping, do they really go back to buying in a store?
Wow.
I don't know. But I doubt it. I think as more people get used to buying on Amazon or buying on Whole Foods or Walmart or other online Instacart, that's going to accelerate. So for you, I think it's thinking through for a restaurant, how do we make that experience work for people? Maybe it's shipping direct to them.
Yeah.
Maybe it's being able to sell through grocery stores or Deliver Me Food or Uber Eats, all those things.
Yeah.
But I don't think a lot of people go back so quickly to eating in a restaurant, even if it's at every other table, even if you're not allowed to sit across from your family. I don't know.
You know, so I'm with you 1,000% on all that. There's one chart from Morgan Stanley's research that I recently read, just one chart that has me just questioning that line of thinking, but it hasn't convinced me yet. And the chart is this. I wish I could pull it up right now. I should have had it ready. The chart is this. China's reopened. Wuhan's reopened. Everything's reopened in China. Okay. In fact, Apple stores were reopening right when we were beginning our crisis. And Morgan Stanley went and looked at a slew of restaurants, factories, everything to see how much did they go down during their major crisis, their corona crisis, and then where are they now? What capacity utilization level are they at now? And so lo and behold, their restaurants, factories, all their companies, Apple stores, it's back to like 75, 80%. Some industries are back to 90. Most are in the 70s to 80s. And I was like, wow, that's way more than I expected. And they've only reopened in the last 3 weeks. So I was like, shit, if we give China another 2-3 weeks, are they back at 90, 100%? Is Morgan Stanley's research accurate? Have they taken a good survey and really went in to see if restaurants are back at 70, 80% sales? So that's the only thing I've seen that has me questioning. And obviously, it's coming out of China. So the question marks in my head are popping up around the data. But there is also this element of human beings forget like this. You know what I mean? So I'm still with
you. I hope I come back on the show in 6 months to apologize profusely to the audience because I was so wrong. Ignoring the questionability of the data, let's say that it is accurate. My thought is just that China, you have to go back to work. Like you don't have a choice about whether or not you go back to work. The government, you have to go back or you get fined.
Even when it comes to things like work, the communist regime is that heavy-handed?
Yeah, you think they're cool with you being like, I don't want to go back to the factory?
Well, I guess I pictured it as like, a person can quit from their job if they so choose.
Yeah, but then what are you going to do for work or to feed your family?
Right, right. No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying.
Yeah, like, so I mean, I don't know if they. I doubt that they. And I don't. I'm not a China expert, so I'm speculating here. But if you say I don't want to go back to my factory job, I don't think that the communist government is going to say, that's cool, we'll just give you this other job.
Yeah, right, right.
So I think that most people, for that reason, go back to their factory job.
Okay,
in the U.S., I think it's going to be way different because I don't think people are going to want to go back to work in the same way or be willing to. I'm also thinking through things like, so for your employees, state unemployment pays, let's call it 450, 500 a month, a week on average, 500 a week on average to keep the numbers easy. The federal government's then supplementing an extra 600 a week for 16 weeks. So you're taking home about 1100 a week. That's after tax. So that's equivalent to about a $70,000 a year job. And you've got that for 16 weeks. So I think it's going to be hard for most American employers to convince their staff to come back to work for at least the next 4 months when they could collect unemployment, not have to work, not have to be exposed to corona,
right,
and move along that way. So I don't know, how much would you have to pay one of your staff members to actually work and be exposed to corona to make up for the fact that they're going to be working? Maybe 100,000, maybe 120. And that probably doesn't work in your restaurant model.
Doesn't make any sense, right?
So I think that we are going to have big challenges that China is not facing when it comes to
this
putting the population back to work.
This is a really important detail that I wasn't aware of. So wait, I'm aware of the 500 from the state unemployment insurance. Is the additional supplemental 600 from the federal government part of the CARES Act? Or what?
Yes.
And does that go to everyone?
Correct. Everybody on unemployment.
Oh, no shit. And is it regardless of what your salary was pre-corona?
No, so your unemployment number is figured, how much you get is based on how much you were making.
Right.
So I'm talking in terms of max benefit. And then I don't know if the 600 is scaled based on what you were making. We would have to look into that.
Gotcha. Okay, makes sense. Wow, okay. Yeah, wow. So let's just take a step back, man, because you're giving some sober fucking truths here, man. Like, you're saying, like, hey, depression is real. Anyone who's not taking it serious. Yeah, so, like, okay, here, the best example, right, Jonathan? The best example is the stock market. You've obviously seen the bounce. Trump just tweeted this morning, 4 days straight up, the biggest increase in the stock market since 1974, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And to me, that's like, all right, fucking sell right now. Now's the time to sell.
Right.
So my thought is, you know, is this, by the way, I've been looking at some charts from 2008. We went down 30% when Lehman and Merrill Lynch, when they went down and Freddie and Fannie were taken into conservatorship, we went down straight 30%. And then we actually bounced. I think everyone thought, like, holy fuck, we lost Bear, Lehman, Merrill, Fannie, Freddie, and we have to now pass TARP. Holy shit. Okay, well, problem solved. We bounce 15%. But then we went down from there another like 20, 25, maybe 30. In fact, maybe more because we bounced. We probably went down another 30 to 40, 35% from there. It feels to me, if I had to bet right now, which I am, I have not really fully invested yet, cash I have on the sidelines, I'm betting we go down here another 30%. I don't think anyone has, I don't care who you are, chief economist of the World Bank, whoever the fuck you want to bring. My opinion is we don't know, no one knows what's on the other side of corona when it comes to the economy. And you are saying, hey man, I think I know, if I'm going to guess, I'm going to bet that we're closer to a depression. You don't just lose 17 million jobs in a month and think, oh, we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think all those people go back to work that quickly. I think it's a lot easier to fire people than it is to rehire them. So all the people that you released from the restaurant, are you planning on bringing everybody back right away as soon as you can?
I can give you the best impression of how I'm going to do it, right? So I sat everyone down at one time. It was about 20 employees. We all got together in the dining room, and I gave them the sober truth. I'm like, number one, we're not paying rent. We're probably not going to pay utilities because no one's coming in this place. Number two, I'm going to do my best to pay you guys, but start filing for unemployment now. Try and get ahead of the curve. And number three, don't touch your faces and wash your hands a lot. see you guys. That was kind of like my attitude. I was trying to be a lot more compassionate than that. But that was how I basically let him go. Now bringing him back, you want to know how I bring him back? Juan, I've got an order for the University of Chicago Hospital for 25 meals. Do you want to come in for an hour and come do it? Maybe, you know, like they're like now on call. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So like I'm bringing people back with major trepidation. My guess is if that's how I am, a lot of people who own businesses are firing like this and bringing one person back at a time with trepidation.
Yeah, so again, the whole point there is that's why I think if we have to use letters of the alphabet, I think it's more like an L-shaped recession than a V or a U. I think we're gonna be down in the recession for a while. Also, the other thing that I'm thinking through, Amr, is like, so $2 trillion is what we just spent pumping up. We didn't pump up the economy. We really spent it to replace $2 trillion in payroll in other areas that would have been there anyways. So we're filling a void.
Right.
We're not increasing the economy at all.
Right.
And then we're probably going to have to take on at least another couple trillion to get us past the next hurdle. So I don't understand, and again, I'm a poli sci major, I'm not an economist, but how do we take 4 trillion and just create that and print that and not have it have a very lasting effect on the economy?
You know, people ask the same question when we did 4 trillion, 5 trillion to the banks in 2008, because that's what the Fed did, right? They basically bought up all sorts of loans from banks to the tune of $4 or $5 trillion. And by the way, they still have a big chunk of that on their balance sheet.
Yeah.
And it was not inflationary. So I do think that, I think what the Fed looks at is like, does the depression and the lack of spending in the economy deflate so much that our $4 or $5 trillion just kind of balances it out, if you know what
I mean. I think part of the problem is getting us out of this deflationary death spiral. And I don't want to bore the audience with, all the economic geekery, but we are somehow going to have to get people confident again, because right now people aren't buying washer dryers.
Right.
They don't want to go lease a car because one, they're worried about using their savings. Two, they don't have any income. But three, they're like, if I wait a month, the price of a car will probably be lower, or a washer dryer. And when the consumer thinks that way, then that puts us in that deflationary spiral, because then the washer dryer guys, they have to reduce their prices.
Right.
And then the consumer is like, well, I see that they just put them on sale, but maybe in July, they'll go down again.
That's
so then they have to reduce it again. So I think that there's a lot of challenges there. And I'm reading and listening to a lot of interesting thoughts like, you know, maybe we have to onshore in order to start to create inflation so that we can save the economy. In other words, what does it look like? We've spent all this time offshoring, all this time optimizing, having things produced in Mexico, produced in China.
Yeah.
But if we want to put Americans back to work, maybe we have a public works program, or we start doing more manufacturing in the U.S. at higher salaries, which means that we're going to cause inflation and possibly pump the economy back up that way. But yeah. I think the reason I bring it up is just because I think a lot of people who are still kind enough to be listening to us this far into the podcast, you need to think very differently about what's going to have to happen to get things back to the new normal. It's not going to simply be like it was after the Great Recession. I think we're going to have to see another public works program, roads, tunnels, bridges, infrastructure, or we're going to have to see manufacturing, onshoring, having Americans do work that we've spent the last 10 years getting China and Mexico to do for cheaper.
Wow.
We may have to bring a lot of that back. And that sucks that we're going to have to, what is it, de-optimize?
Yeah.
But that may be part of the solution.
I mean, we're not jumping into economics. I would be hard. I don't think our government, I mean, maybe with Trump, that's a total possibility. But it just feels like the momentum, even when Trump tried to promote companies to bring stuff back from Mexico, to fire up the old Ohio plants and Pennsylvania plants and whatever, it didn't feel like that really got any traction. I personally just just from my gut, not from any data or real place, just from my gut, I don't see that happening in any way. The other thing that's really strong in this country, man, I'm so sad to say this. I'm so fucking sad to say this, is there's this really strong momentum to the wealth gap. Really, really strong. I don't care if you're Republican. I don't care if you're Democrat. I don't care if you're Trump or Bush. I don't care if you're Obama. It's only gotten bigger and wider, and the rich keep getting richer. It just seems to me that we've arrived at a place in our economy where very wealthy people have a really good grip on Washington in such a way where laws get passed regularly, whether it's for a pharmacy company, a pharmaceutical, or some defense company, where they've got a lock on making sure the wealthier keep getting wealthier. And, you know, we just stay an average of 50 grand a year for the average middle American. So I can't see that happening. Unfortunately, we'd have to have some sort of drastic Bernie Sanders, Andrew Yang kind of measure to really get out of this deflationary cycle, in my opinion. I'm struggling to see it actually happening. But that's just my opinion right now.
No, understood. I realize that a lot of these thoughts are tough to think through, and we're going to need some time. Again, for me, it's just the faster we work through the phases of grief and get to acceptance and start to figure out the new normal, I think that's how we thrive. I think right now a lot of people are on the mat, don't want to get up, have hit pause on their lives, and are just waiting to get to May 1st to hopefully have the world reopen and go back to normal.
Yeah.
And I think that for the people listening, it's like the faster that you can get back up off the mat, the better.
Do you, okay, so in your honest opinion, as you followed politics the last decade and a half, it's great that you're a poli-sci guy. Do you believe our government, who has the most power and control over this situation, do you believe our government has shown a pattern of embracing the reality, of confronting the truth, and then dealing with it, or do you feel like that is not one of our strengths as a country and as a government?
So the short answer is no. I don't think the government is good at embracing the realities and moving it forward. But you know, when we say the government, we're really talking about us. Like, it is still, you know, we're democratic. We get to vote. So I think in large part, we aren't really willing to embrace what needs to happen. So a lot of people that do vote are dependent right now on Social Security benefits, on Medicare benefits, and there are huge gaps in how we're going to pay for those costs. So I think we have to think through what we're willing to do with that piece. Yeah. And agnostic of my personal beliefs, it doesn't matter. We still have to figure out how we pay for that. And then for all of our millennials that are listening, and I'm like one finger into being a millennial, you know, born in 81. Yep. It's like we are going to need to get involved and vote if we want to also affect the future as well. And we haven't seemed to be that willing to get involved or to vote in the numbers needed to make change either. So I don't want to put it off on the government as if that's something unrelated to all of us. I think we really are our government in this country. So we're going to need to really think about what we want the future to be.
That is the truth. Absolutely. I'm fully behind you, full agreement with that. It just seems to me that it's more a dialogue than a monologue. What I mean is, like, when you say, which is the truth, we are the government. For me, that kind of feels like a monologue. What are we all going to say we want to have happen in this country? But I think it's more a dialogue in the sense of, like, when Trump starts saying, you know, the Charlottesville riots, there's good people on both sides, and that's totally an acceptable thing. It doesn't come out and speak strongly against something like that, right? Then you just start seeing all these unfortunate incidents, like the Jewish synagogue. Happened shortly thereafter. I forget the name of the synagogue now. It's escaping me. But like, people kind of will respond to what our leaders are saying. You know what I mean? So, and that's how I see it, as a dialogue. And I feel like what we've been, you know, putting into office as people has an impact on us. And it's, so it's kind of a two-way street in a way. And I just feel like you're pretty much right. It is us putting them in. And once we install those leaders, they then feed us back what we just installed. And so it creates this, almost like a bad cycle. And I feel like something radical, I mean, everyone says this, right? But it's really true. Something radical is needed to kind of stop this deflationary cycle, embrace the reality and truth that our solution for 2008 was probably really shitty. And we're kind of probably bearing the brunt of that right now. And what solution are we going to have for 2020 Corona? I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's going to be the best solution, in my opinion. But so anyway, those are my thoughts about, can we embrace that reality? I want to get back to this idea of depression that you're proposing, of like dodging the depression. Let's assume that the government does not handle this very well, right? Let's go with the most probabilistic, most likely situation scenario. They fumble it. They don't make the optimal decisions. They don't listen to the best economists. So what does that mean for 20 million, 25 million unemployed? What does that mean for business owners, right? Let's talk about business news and other shit. What does that mean for you? What does that mean for me? What would you be telling your clients? Like, hey, I don't know. I think Washington and our we as a people are going to fumble this. And so here's what I would do if I were you, dude who owns 10 gyms. I know that was your old life. Dude who owns a restaurant.
I talked this morning to a dude that owns a gym in Pasadena. And so they're shut down right now. And my thought for him is, think through how you can do that virtually. Because I do think people are going to want personal training in the future. I just think that they're going to want to do it in the safety and comfort of their home and do it over Zoom. I mean, we've seen a lot of growth. Like, this is perfect for Peloton. You know, they are already have a big platform for this. And it's already perfectly socially distant, but it still feels human since you're, you know, racing against everybody else. I mean, what a boon for them. So I think for all the service providers, I want them to think through, like, how do you use technology to be successful in a socially distant environment? So earlier, before we started, I was showing you guys how I ripped my bedroom, my guest bedroom apart, you know, in January.
Show us again. Show the YouTube viewers.
Yeah,
sure.
Let's set up again.
Yeah, cool.
Show them your shithole setup.
Yeah, so this is where the bed was in our guest bedroom. And so my wife in January very graciously helped me carry out the bed. And then we were able to take and put in this ring of fire, all these lights. If you can see, if I switch back, I can't even create a shadow. Like, there's no way because of the lights. I've got several cameras. I've got several microphones so that if one of them drops, I can flip to a backup quickly. I don't have to worry, like on Zoom, I'm not getting on every call with my clients and being like, can you hear me? For the audience, if you're just listening, I was just faking like cutting it out. But
can't stand that shit.
Yeah, it's annoying. But I think that for like, so we were talking about like the audience. And so you're saying, you know, a lot of people that are listening to us, or maybe, you know, you're a financial advisor or you're a manager or a leader. It's thinking through how are you going to work in the future virtually? How can you embrace technology and still make it feel like we're in the same room so that you can be drawing on a digital whiteboard or having your iPad connected to Zoom so that you can sketch something out for a client to make it feel like you're with them. You know, how can we create an experience? Because the world is going this way. If you want to go to the next level with me, Amar, I think it's that in a couple of years, we're going to have virtual reality headsets on. And then it's going to feel like we're sitting at a virtual conference table all together in the same room without having to travel to meet each other in person. You know, we'll be able to virtually shake hands. The world, again, my thought for my clients is to think about how we can leverage technology to take it to the next level. And then the next piece is think about the industries that will do well. In the book, I've got a table because I looked at the Great Recession. It's like, you know, hotels got crushed. Four-year universities got crushed. But guns and ammo did very well in the Great Recession. Veterinary clinics did very well in the Great Recession because people don't care. If it's for your dog, you're going to put the money on a credit card. So they're going to do fine. you know, health does fine. Hospitals, people still need that in a recession or depression. So you need to just think through for your clients who you're aligned with. If right now you're a financial advisor and you mostly work with the cruise ship industry, probably not going to be good. I would be working on how you're going to pivot right now and be managing money for hospital executives, for pharmaceutical executives, for executives of SaaS companies, because I think all of those are going to do very well going forward.
Right.
But it's just the thought for all of us to slow down, to do your deep work, get some good coffee, and in the morning, run through your client list and think through the exposure they have.
You really are the recession expert, brother. This is great.
Well, thanks. Well, I spent the last couple of years studying this, and then we published the book in September of last year because I thought there was going to be a recession in 2020 because of what was going on with the yield curve. It had nothing to do with me, you know, prognosticating a coronavirus. So this has tipped us into recession, but a lot of recessions happen because of black swan events.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's really, we were getting closer and closer because of the yield curve.
Yeah.
And then a novel virus, it's not like this didn't happen with the Spanish flu.
Right.
I mean, that was 100 years ago. But exactly. My other thought, Amr, is this is going to happen more and more because the population of the planet, you know, we're approaching 8 billion.
Yeah.
As we get more densely populated, as we cover the earth with more and more cement,
yeah,
I think we're going to have more natural disasters,
yeah,
more viruses, more tornadoes, more hurricanes, more typhoons. It's just the science of how the earth is probably going to react to the increasing population load and the load on the environment.
Damn, you're basically saying that the more people we have in this world, the more we kind of spin out of control and more shit happens. And we're basically walking ourselves towards judgment day is what you're trying to say, right, Jonathan?
I think it's going to take tens of thousands of years. And I do, again, I think we're...
Oh, man, depends on how much sex we have.
Exactly. Well, that's funny.
That's my attempt at being a comedian, brother.
I think it is trying to figure out, like for Corona, though, it's thinking through questions on our, like, do we have a mini baby boom because everybody's stuck at home right now? Or does domestic abuse go up because everybody's stuck at home right now? I mean, those are...
It's up, by the way. I have a police officer who comes into the restaurant almost every night. Victor, wonderful guy. And I'm like, the first week, he's like, man, it's quiet out there. I'm like, really? He's like, nothing. Week two, he's like, yo, a dude just got shot down the street. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah. And then I keep going to people's houses because all these men keep beating up their wives. I'm like, get out of here. Week three, he's like, domestic abuse is up 35-40%. I'm like, get out of here. This is in Chicago, right? In the heart of Chicago. So I think domestic abuse is up already. But what was your line of thinking? Like what, where do you take that thinking? What does that mean for you?
There wasn't a there there.
You're just saying these are all consequences.
Yeah. I mean, I wish it was that we're going to have a baby boom because people will be at home. There won't be much else to do except, be loving and enjoy each other. And at the same time, I also know that, you know, I'm very lucky. Like we were talking about it, like we have resources. I'm able to homeschool our kids. We have a good internet connection. Their school gave them Chromebooks on the last day. And so we're able to do that. I do think we have to think through what you brought up, which is the wealth gap between the haves and the have-nots, and that this is going to disproportionately stress the have-nots. And that's, we got to figure out how we're going to deal with that as a society. And I don't have an answer for you on that.
I love, dude, you are clearly, Jonathan, a thinker, brother. I like that. I like this conversation. Dolder, am I the only one enjoying this conversation with this dude?
I enjoy this.
He's really, you've really thought through some stuff and it's really valuable and helpful. And it's not like you're just saying superficial shit. You got background to back it up. So, but Jonathan, let's go back a step. So, do you really think in your heart, man, do you really think we're not going to go back as supposedly as quickly as China's going back? Like, I know, I agree. I hope I'm wrong. I hope you're wrong. But like, why, tell me from some of your deep thinking, why have you arrived at the most likely thing is we don't go back and we really are doing virtual? one of the things I've been talking about for comedy, because comedy is a dialogue. People think comedy, you just stand up there and you hold a mic and you just give a monologue. No. No, it's back and forth. You say a joke, and then you wait for the person to respond, and you say another joke, and if they laugh even harder, your third joke, you deliver it even more powerfully because you're now more confident, blah, blah, blah. So it's a dialogue. So no stages, no social gatherings, zero comedy. It does not work. And I've been bringing up the idea like, yo, VR comedy or Zoom comedy. You have 100, 200, 300 people in the room. You deliver the joke and you wait for the response. You deliver. These late night shows, I can't believe they haven't fucking picked up on this. I can't, Colbert used to be my favorite. I can't stand watching him anymore. Fallon, Oliver is the closest. John Oliver is the closest to being watchable, but they're all just a shell of their former self. So that's another example of like, you know, you're right. Like people need to figure out the virtual realm. It's happening. But like, do you have anything you've thought through to back up why you think we're not going to go back that quickly? Is it simply the United States is different than China and all this money that people have from unemployment insurance is basically going to keep people at home? Is that what you think? Or do you think it's the second wave, or do you think it's both?
Both potentially, but the first issue I have is that we are 50 states, and different states are going to open up at different times. And so I think right now people are getting stir crazy. Even smart people that understand viruses and how they travel are getting stir crazy and just want to go back to normal. So people are getting more brazen with being willing to go out. And I don't think that states like Texas are going to put up with being locked down any longer than they have to. So I am worried that we're going to have people going out, circulating, and ultimately, like for this weekend, I fully expect for Easter weekend that you're going to see people getting together at mega churches and big family gatherings. And I'm worried about what will happen there. So I think we have to think through all those pieces. If we were one country that was locked down, I think that would be a very different circumstance. But I think if each of the states gets to pick the timeline, that is a big challenge. And I think that the ethos of the American people is just way different. Like we were the ones that dumped the tea in the harbor because we believe that nobody's going to tell us what to do.
Rebellion day one.
We've got our guns and we are not giving them back and we are not going to be told what to do. So I totally get that. And I'm an American, proud to be an American, completely understand it. But I do think that the virus loves it. The virus is licking its chops.
Oh, shit.
Just waiting for us to get back together so that, again, it can attack us and spread itself because we're in a war and we are at a war with a virus. And the virus wants us to get together because that's how it spreads. So again, for that reason, I think it's going to be very difficult because of where we come from mentally us to beat this thing.
All right, so let's paint the picture, all right, brother? So we paint the picture. Texas goes back. A few of these states go back. And in, let's say, May 1st, all right? Some states don't, like New York, Chicago, maybe they don't. They've been, in Ohio, you get... We are Ohio and Illinois have been kind of ahead of this a little bit. Yeah. New York was not fully ahead of it. But so let's say, like you said, Texas goes back and we don't go back. All these cases start popping up in Texas. They have their second wave. That spooks the shit out of all the rest of us. And so then May, June comes around and we're like, no, close down again or stay closed down. You're saying that's kind of how it could look is you start to see a second wave. And even if you don't see a full second wave, even remnants of a second wave might spook out the rest of the states. And so you just, that's how you get a prolonged stay at home thing. And so the sooner a person realizes that's how it could play out and the sooner a person pivots, the better.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at the data from Japan and Singapore, which reopened too early and now are experiencing a second wave. I think we can see what happens. And then I'm also not confident. Like I know for Mexico, I was talking to some of my friends that own a business in Mexico, and Mexico apparently is not counting the private tests in their official numbers.
Okay.
And so we don't know what the real count is in Mexico. And that's a country that is more developed. So I think there are many countries where we just have no idea either because the government isn't sharing or doesn't know exactly what it is. So for all those reasons, I think we need to think through new opportunities, how we can pivot, all that stuff. But also, the message is that this is a great time to learn new skills. Like, we're all on pause for the rest of this month. And so I know people are tired of this because people are just trying to survive, you know, just trying to get by, just trying to have their kids not drive them crazy. But at the same time, like, if you have always wanted to learn Spanish because, you know, you're a financial advisor and you think you could pick up a lot of the Spanish speaking market, now is a great time to start doing some Duolingo, figuring out, you know, the vocabulary you really need to get after it. Or figuring out, like, virtually, you know, you're talking about comics. I mean, there are going to be comics that figure it out, that figure out a way to do a webcast with a live audience and get feedback. And I don't know exactly how to do that, but the first comics that figure that shit out are going to have IP that's very valuable to the rest of the community. And I vibe with what you're saying, because I did a 90-minute webinar yesterday, and it's tough, man. I mean, you get no response, because the first thing we did was mute the entire audience because we don't want background noise. And so then I get zero feedback. And I was telling you guys earlier before we started, I do a lot of speaking on stage. Well, at least I used to. But, you know, in a room with 200 or 300 people, you get feedback.
Yeah.
You see the audience smiling. You can hear them laughing, or you can hear them not laughing when I, you know, I lay an egg and I, you know, I try to tell a joke, just doesn't go over. And then what you can do with the audience, though, is then you can make them laugh by being like, sorry, that wasn't my timing. What's up with that? My joke wasn't very good. I apologize. It's too early in the morning. I get it. And then they'll laugh and you can draw it out of them. That's not possible over Zoom if you're doing a webinar, but somebody's going to figure out how to get that response. And the same thing is, you know, I told you guys I do consulting for companies. It's figuring out with those companies, how do I know who's engaged in my meeting? You know, how do I know if they're really thinking through there, or they're just sitting there staring at the camera, wondering when I'm going to be done with the meeting and when this will be over. So whoever, you know, I'm working to figure out all those pieces as well to create interaction.
Blowing my mind, Jonathan Slane. You're blowing my mind, dude. Holy shit. Hey, brother. We need to pivot ourselves for a moment here. I bet listeners like me are benefiting from how much you have thought this through, my man. I don't think as many people as you think. You're too close to yourself. I don't think you realize how much you've thought this through. I'm serious, brother.
Thank you.
Right, so you've thought this shit through more than most people, in my opinion. I think we're all stuck on the WhatsApp, email, shallow shit. And I try and practice Cal's deep work thing. I'm not going to lie to you, man. I struggle with it, right? But tell us a little. Let's pivot to you, brother. You've written this great book, Rock the Recession. That's the book, right?
Yeah.
You are a consultant. Let's do a mini plug. Where can people learn about you?
Yeah, so they can get the book on Amazon. And then my website is recession.com.
Recession what?
.com.
Recession.com. You own recession.com?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Did you have to buy it from someone?
I did buy it from someone.
You had to, because that was taken back in 2001, I'm sure.
But I bought it a couple years ago.
Yeah. To the extent you're willing to share, are you willing to share how much you had to pay for it?
You want to take a guess and then I'll tell you? Yeah. I don't know if I've ever, let me think about if I've ever said this on an interview.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have, but if you get within, should we make it sporting that you can get within a certain amount?
Yes.
Just go ahead and guess and then I'll tell you. How much do you think recession.com?
I think you paid 12 grand for recession.com.
You're pretty damn close. It was 18,400.
Ooh. No, man, that was a hard check to write, wasn't it?
Well, we started at 25, and we landed at 18.4. The funny thing is, I was also in negotiation for recessionproof.com, which I ended up buying as well. Yeah. That guy also wanted 25,000, but after I told him that I had bought Recession for 18.4, he came way down.
Yeah.
If people go to recession.com, they can find me. But the cool thing on the site, we've got a free 20-question survey. And we call it a recession readiness assessment. It'll give you a score from 0 to 100. If you get a 0, probably going to have a bankruptcy in the next recession. If you get 100, you're probably looking forward to it. and we've had thousands of people do it. The average score right now is a 52.
You know what you need to do? Oh, really? You know, you need to teach a class. That's what you need to do. I can't believe you're not an economist. And you should probably get like a 1-year master's in economics and just go teach. You also need to have like you could teach this shit with your eyes closed. Just do one class at some random college somewhere just to be able to say you're also the professor of recessions, because you probably know this better than a lot of economists, man.
Well, I've been reading a lot about it. I know that for the book, we read every research paper ever written with the word recession in it. And so a lot of the book is evidence-based. It's not our opinions, but really just interviewing people that grew their company, that grew themselves through the recession, to see what they did differently than everybody else. And the thing that they all said was that they started really with assessing where they were at and benchmarking their situation. And that's why we did the assessment on the site, is so that if people want to know, what should I do now that I listen to you guys scare me and depress me for an hour, it's start with benchmarking yourself with the free assessment. And then from there, if you like my stuff, you can buy the workbook on the site, and there's some other products, and you can get the book. But that's really the starting point for people.
Say another couple sentences, if you don't mind, about assessing where they're at.
Yeah, so think through, like, the 20 questions are designed to help you figure out, do you have a war chest of cash available to be able to pounce in a recession? Do you have a line of credit, whether it's a home equity line of credit or a business line of credit that you can tap so that in a recession you can survive if necessary, but really more interestingly, to purchase assets. I mean, think through, there's gonna be a lot of foreclosures. There will be a lot of restaurants that go out of business. There will be a lot of gyms that go out of business. You can go buy equipment for your restaurant or for your gym for very cheap. But what you need to do is to talk to your banker now and let them know, hey, when you see these industrial ovens or a salamander come available, I would love for you to call me because I want to buy that stuff. Because banks don't want to own restaurant equipment. Because you know this, you're a banker. For us to sell it, you got to go get it appraised. Yeah. Then you got to hire an auctioneer, and the auctioneer is going to want a third of it. You got to store it until the auction. Sucks. That's going to cost money. All that means that they will sell whatever they have for 10% of its value just to get rid of it. And so, but the way that those deals happen that I don't think a lot of people realize, Amr, is you got to let your banker know now what you want to buy. And then when they get that stuff in their inventory on their balance sheet, they'll hopefully think to call you and sell it to you. So it's thoughts like that that are in the book.
Even like a Chase banker, you walk into the Chase, like he wouldn't know, would he?
Yeah, no, but I think your Chase banker, your relationship manager can introduce you to the workout bankers that will be the ones that will have the assets. So I doubt that your local banker will be the one that does the deal, but they can introduce you. So in the Great Recession, this was one thing that I was really good at, was putting a lot of banks on notice that I wanted to buy gym equipment. And then they would call me inbound when they had gyms that went out of business, and they would send me an Excel spreadsheet. It would be like 35,000 of equipment. And I would say, hey, look, if you want it, I'll overnight you a cashier's check for a couple $1,000. And they'd be like, all right, let me call you back. They'd call me back in an hour and be like, if you send us the check now and you go pick it up within a week, it's yours. Wow. It would cost me more to get the U-Haul than it would to buy the actual equipment.
No shit.
I think people, I just want them, these are the kinds of things we're thinking through in the book, because you need to do some proactive stuff now so that when we're officially in a recession and everybody's seeing it on CNN, on Fox News, and the foreclosures happen, that your banker will get in touch with you.
Right, right, right. Okay, so in my case, you would say, all right, Amr, you think you've figured out some stuff with delivery and takeout that's really good, with double wrapping, with making it safe. You think you've figured out getting the food into the grocery stores and the prepackaged meals and individual box catering. You figured that out? Okay, cool. Here's your opportunity, Amr. If you have some cash laying around, 100 grand, 200 grand, a line of credit for 200 grand, you might have $250,000, $500,000 to work with. As your banker starts to call you in May and June to tell you, pick up this broiler, pick up this salamander, pick up this delivery truck, what you can do is start also opening maybe a second location in the Gold Coast or in Lincoln Park or something like that, or near Midwestern University out in the western suburbs. And now you have And now you have a second location that you basically got on for pennies on the dollar between equipment and the, and signing the new lease. And in the recession / depression, you've now picked up a second location. And if you can, you know, leverage that second location, maybe you continue to get inbound calls from your banker letting you know, hey, we got more and we got more and we got more. And so now I become the guy who's there to possibly scoop up whatever the those who are struggling and weren't able to pivot, I'm able to grab their stuff on the cheap and position me for the next decade.
You got it. Yeah, I think that's how you rock the recession.
Shit, I think I owe you some money for this podcast, dude. This was a hugely beneficial.
Tell me about it. All right, well, I appreciate you having me on. I like the long format. Generally, we don't get to get into all the detail that we did, so hopefully the audience hung in there with us, got some value out of it, and can go do the assessment, and then happy to come back on in maybe 6 months, and we can talk about what Let's the scores it. Are trending as, and then figure out what's next. And if I'm wrong, if we've already bounced back, I'll come on the show, and happy to apologize and hope I am.
Same here. Hey, man. So, okay, recession.com, rock the recession. You have jumped on this podcast. I feel like it's almost like day one or day two of what really I also believe with you is a pretty difficult time period we're about to go through, and a difficult, very difficult recession, maybe depression we're about to go through. And so mark my words, this dude should be on CNBC and CNN helping people out. If you're not already, dude, good luck with all that because it's coming to you. And if you all are listening, check out Jonathan Slane, recession.com. This dude will change the way you approach your business. Thank you, brother. Dolder, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enjoy that shithole studio you have, Jonathan.
Well, dude. Thanks, Amar. Rock on.
Peace, guys.
See ya.
Disclaimer, I do not provide personal investment advice and I am not a qualified licensed investment advisor. I am an amateur investor. All information found here, including any ideas, opinions, views, predictions, forecasts, commentaries, suggestions, or stock picks expressed or implied herein are for informational, entertainment, or educational purposes only and should not be construed as personal investment advice. While the information provided is believed to be accurate, it may include errors or inaccuracies. I will not and cannot be held liable for any actions you take as a result of anything you read, hear, or see here. Conduct your own due diligence, consult a licensed financial advisor or broker before making any and all investment decisions. Any investments, trades, speculations, or decisions made on the basis of any information found in this show, expressed or implied herein, are committed at your own risk, financial or otherwise. Business News and Other Shit, hereafter known as BNOS, reflects my own views, ideas, and opinions. It is not a production of my employer, nor is it affiliated with any broker-dealer or registered investment advisor. No representations or warranties are made with respect to the accuracy or completeness of the content of this entire show, including any links to other sites. The links provided are maintained by their respective organizations, and they are solely responsible for their content. All information presented here is provided as is, without warranty of any kind, expressed or implied. From time to time, I may include affiliate links and advertisements on BNOS that result in my receiving a payment should a visitor click on the link or sign up to a service as per established in their practice. Readers are entirely responsible for any actions they take as a result of reading or clicking on links on the site and are urged to read the small print. Sound fair enough? Then please subscribe to BNOS. It's free via RSS or email.